Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli and Tim Maurer.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. Timothy is not here tonight, but that's okay. I've got a guest tonight that I think is probably one of the more fascinating guests that you're going to hear from. And the reason is, there's numerous reasons, but one of the main ones is because I believe, as an investor or doing your personal finances, one of the most important topics today for an American citizen is to understand currencies and how they operate and how they affect your life. Most Americans don't think anything of currencies because we're the world currency reserve and we think, you know, hey, it doesn't matter if the dollar goes up and down. And the rest of the world understands that, yes, it does matter deeply if your currency is depreciating or appreciating and what that means to you as an investor and your personal finances and so forth. And I think Jim Rickards is going to bring new insight to you about this with his latest book, Currency Wars. And we're going to talk about that with him. I could go into a long dissertation about his resume, but I think one of the most fascinating things we can do to understand who he is and the power of the background that he has and the connections that he has is we're just going to let him tell a story right now about currency wars and why his book is called Currency Wars. Jim, are you there? Jim?
Thank you.
There he is. He's there with
Hi,
me.
Drew.
There you are. How are you doing, Jim?
Doing fine, thank you.
Now, you know, I wanted to just get into, because we're here in Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland. We're only about 30 miles away from a really strategic place you mentioned in the book, Currency Wars. And it's such a fascinating topic. I just figured I'd let you tell that story so that my listeners can understand the caliber of the person on the this interview with me.
Sure, Drew, I'd be glad to. First of all, just to the listeners, I actually lived in Baltimore for 5 years. I went to undergraduate and graduate school at Johns Hopkins.
Does that make you a Raven fan?
Well, actually, when I was there, the Colts were still the team. I was this is back in the Ice Age, but actually, I earned my way through college by driving for Jimmy's Cabs up in Towson.
Yeah, absolutely, the blue cabs, right?
Yeah, I'm an honest-to-goodness Baltimore on for many years and love the city and have a lot of good friends there. So
good.
Definitely have some roots in Baltimore. But yeah, I think the place you're referring to, Drew, is called the Applied Physics Laboratory.
And I've taught many seminars there myself, so I know it well.
You know, well, it's part of Johns Hopkins University, but sort of a standalone facility. And their main function, they are a top secret both weapons laboratory and space exploration laboratory. So they do both, but they have another function. They're a place that does a lot of war game facilities for the Pentagon. So, of course, the Pentagon's been doing war games for decades, but they need a place to do it, and you need what's called game design, who are the teams going to be, and so forth. And the Applied Physics Laboratory down in Laurel, Maryland, as you say, about 30 miles from Baltimore, has all those facilities. A few years ago, I was invited to help structure and participate in a war game. But this was not your usual war game. We did not have, aircraft carriers or armored divisions or infantry or anything of the kind. This was going to be a game fought using financial weapons. So the only weapons you could use would be stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, and derivatives. So it was the first time the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, ever did a financial war game. We did it at the Applied Physics Laboratory. And I talk about this in my book, Currency Wars. It actually is the first two chapters of the book. There's a lot else in the book about the international monetary system and the future of that system. But we thought we'd start off with this particular story because it really shows the connection between financial matters and national security. Those are usually thought of as separate things. You know, we have the Federal Reserve and the United States Treasury worries about the dollar, and the military and the intelligence community worry about national security. But those two things actually come together. And one of the things I say in my book is that you cannot have a strong national security with a weak currency. If you want to be a strong country, you need a strong currency. And so the efforts right now by the Federal Reserve to weaken the dollar and cheapen the dollar through their quantitative easing are actually a threat to national security. And that was one of the things we explored during the war game.
So let's just put this in context. So the main military people, the main treasury people, and the national security people of our country are getting together saying we need to look at the potential of financial attacks on our country. And you're one of the people, you're one of the first people they contact to help to organize this financial war game. That's basically right. What you're talking about, right?
That's right. I have a very long background in finance and banking.
And so, right. And yeah. So, but the point is that they're that concerned about it. I want to make sure my listeners understand that they should be concerned about it if these high-level people are also concerned about it, because it is probably the greatest risk that we have to our personal finances individually, would you say?
Well, yes. And, of course, there is a financial war going on right now, but the U.S. is actually on offense, not defense, and this involves Iran. Going back to last February, President Obama basically kicked Iran out of the dollar payment system. You know, you think about the banking system and how banks move money around. Well, Iran has banks, and they actually need dollars. They, you know, oil is sold in dollars. They're a big oil exporter. They get paid in dollars. They need dollars or other hard currencies to buy things that they import, including things we like, you know, like iPhones and computers, but also wheat and gasoline, et cetera. And so when the U.S. kicked them out of the system that moves dollars, that meant that Iran could not do any more dollar transactions, couldn't even get paid in dollars for their oil. Well, they started moving everything into euros and other currencies, but there's another system in Europe that handles that called SWIFT, and the United States, working with the SWIFT board, kicked Iran out of that also. So we basically excluded Iran from the entire global payment system. So then they had to resort to barter arrangements. A couple things happened right away. First of all, dollars dried up in Iran. And so if you're an Iranian merchant and you want dollars to import goods, you had to get them on the black market, and the price doubled overnight. So if you're paying in reals, that's their currency, to get dollars, everything was twice as expensive because you needed twice as much of your currency to get the black market dollars to buy the imported goods. So this caused inflation in Iran. Then it caused a run on the bank. People in Iran started pulling their money out of the bank. They said, hey, if my money's going to be worthless, I'd like to get my hands on it and maybe buy some dollars myself on the black market. And then the central bank had to raise interest rates up to 20% to stop the run on the bank. So we caused a dollar shortage, imports drying up, hyperinflation, a run on the bank, and sky-high interest rates in Iran, all in an effort to destabilize their government. Now, the government hasn't fallen yet, but this is an outright financial attack. But this is not just hypothetical. This is actually happening in the real world. And here's a case where the U.S. actually attacked Iran using financial weapons. But we're vulnerable ourselves. Somebody could attack us.
Yeah, because, you know, we should wait and do this after we come back from a break. So why don't you hold on with me, Jim, and we're going to come back, talk a lot more about that. But right now I got to go to Terry Troy in traffic, and we're going to be right back. Jim Rickards and his book, Currency Wars. Take it away, Terry.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back with Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Jim Rickards, who wrote the book Currency Wars. And as I was saying at the beginning of the show, if there's probably, in my opinion, one of the most important topics of dealing with your personal finances is understanding currencies and understanding why the United States is the world currency reserve, which is in jeopardy, could mean, you know, a different future for America. So, Jim, that brings us to an interesting topic. You said we were vulnerable, and we are the world currency reserve, though. How vulnerable could we be being the world currency reserve?
Well, you know, just as a data point, Drew, in the year 2000, 70% of all global reserves were denominated in dollars. Today, that number is down to 60%. Now, 60% is still a majority. The dollar is still clearly the leading reserve currency in the world. Now, maybe I should just explain what reserves are. You know, if you make a certain amount of money and you spend a certain amount, but if you make more than you spend, the difference of your savings, you get to put in the bank and maybe invest in stocks or whatever. Well, it's no different for a country. If a country sells more stuff to the rest of the world than it buys, it's going to make a profit.
And before you go any further, we're a country that runs a current account deficit, so we actually spend more than what we make, correct?
That's correct. And the rest, many other countries, they're in the opposite situation. So if you
Asian countries.
That's right. China and Japan and
Korea.
Some Asian countries, Korea, Taiwan, others. And whenever they sell more than they buy, that excess is their reserve position. So then the question is, well, what am I going to invest in? I've got these reserves. I've got to go buy some bonds or stocks or something. And as I say, 60% of those investments by countries, their so-called reserves, are in dollars, but it used to be 70%. So it's going down. Now, by itself, that's not a disaster, but it would be good to see the U.S. Pursue a strong dollar policy. But I also think it's important to understand, so who cares if we have a weak dollar? You know, let's say you live and work in the United States. If you work in the United States and you get paid in dollars and you shop here and you buy gasoline and food here and take vacations here, who cares what the exchange rate is because you're all in dollars? And by the way, that's exactly what President Nixon said in 1971 when he took America off the gold standard. And it might only affect you if you took a European vacation or something like that. But that's actually not true. It affects everybody, and affects everybody because of inflation. Going back to what you said, Drew, we not only export a lot of things. You know, we export Boeing aircraft and General Electric wind turbines, Hollywood films. We export a lot of stuff, but we import a lot more. And if you cheapen the dollar, the price of those imports goes up because the foreign sellers, if the dollar's cheaper, they're going to want more dollars to sell you the same stuff. So there's iPhones and iPads, German cars, and a lot of other things, you know, textiles, clothing, et cetera. Look at the labels. It's all, you know, it's made in China, Thailand, Indonesia, et cetera. But all that stuff gets more expensive if you cheapen the dollar. So the reason that everyday Americans should be concerned, they don't have to be foreign currency traders, but they should know that inflation is on the way and the prices are going to go up if we weaken the dollar anymore. So that's really the argument for having a stronger dollar.
But yet the administration believes that a weaker dollar will boost our manufacturing position in the world because then our goods become cheaper to the rest of the world, so we should have a weaker dollar. As a matter of fact, if you look at the markets over the last few years, every time the dollar gets weaker, the world markets do well, the stock market does well, everybody's happy.
Well, that's the theory. You know, cheapen the dollar and sell more exports, create more jobs. And if we have more exports, we reduce our trade deficit, and that's good for GDP. So it sounds good. The problem is it never works out that way. That's the theory, and that's why the politicians are attracted to it. But in the real world, you have a number of problems. First of all, other countries push back. That's why I call it currency wars. If the United States could act alone, cheapen the dollar, and nothing else would happen, it might work for a short period of time. But that's not the real world. What happens is we cheapen our currency, and then they cheapen their currency. We cheapen it some more with more money printing. They print some more money. And you end up with everyone in the world getting inflation. Or else they'll put on capital controls, which makes it more difficult to invest. Sometimes the currency wars turn into trade wars, where a country says, hey, I can't compete with your cheap currency, so I'm going to put tariffs on. And you look at history. This has happened twice before. And I talk about this in my book. I call it Currency War I in the 1930s and Currency War II in the 1970s. In the 1930s, we had deflation, contraction of world trade, the Great Depression, unused industrial capacity. It was the worst period of American of growth in American history. In the 1970s, we had the opposite. We had inflation, three recessions back-to-back-to-back, the stock market crash, high unemployment. That was the second worst period in American history. So every time we've been in a currency war, we've had disastrous economic performance because of all these unanticipated consequences and people are pushing back. So now we're in the third currency war. It started in 2010. It started for the reason you mentioned, which is President Obama, in his State of the Union address in January 2010, announced what he called the National Export Initiative, designed to double exports in 5 years. Well, that sounds good. It sounds like a good goal, but how are you going to double exports? There aren't going to be twice as many of us. We're not going to get twice as smart. The only way to do that is to cheapen the dollar, but when you cheapen the dollar, all you get is inflation. So this is going to basically steal money out of the pockets of, you know, savers, people on retirement, people with annuities, people with insurance policies. Anybody with any kind of fixed income savings or retirement is going to lose once the inflation hits.
So one of the things that many of our politicians have been continuing to say, excuse me, is that China is a currency manipulator. But, you know, we're currency manipulators, too. We're probably more manipulative than the Chinese are even.
Well, that's right. Look, every major country manipulates its currency to some extent. Your exchange rate is just another policy tool. So they control interest rates through the central bank. They control tax rates through the legislature. And they control exchange rates also partly through the central bank. So all countries manipulate their currency. But the U.S. is the biggest currency manipulator in the world. We've been doing it the longest. You know, you go back to 1913 when the Fed was created. A dollar today is only worth 5%, actually a little bit less than 5% of what it was worth in 1913. So the dollar has lost not over 95% of its purchasing power since the Fed was created in 1913, and that's just going to continue. So, you know, China is actually the big loser here. Everyone says, oh, my goodness, they have, you know, $3 trillion of our debt. They're a major creditor. We're a major debtor. They own all this, all these treasury bills. But we're not going to pay them in real terms. We're going to cheapen the currency and pay them back in kind of phony baloney money. So we'll say to the Chinese, hey, here's your $1 trillion. Good luck buying a loaf of bread because we just printed the money. Well, that hurts the Chinese, obviously, but also hurts everyday Americans because once you cheapen the dollar, it does it not only for Chinese creditors, but also for people in this country.
Well, yeah, I say often when they keep saying that, you know, we want China to stop using their fixed exchange rate. And so, in other words, they say how much they want the yuan to be to the dollar. I think right now it's 6.3 to the dollar. And they want that to float. And I agree. The Chinese would be wise to let it float. But I think that American politicians don't understand what they're going to get when the Chinese do allow their currency to be free-floating. It could be the worst thing that happens to America. Do you agree?
Well, I do. And another thing that a lot of the politicians – first of all, if the Chinese have what's called an open capital account, where they just let the yuan float against the dollar, it's not obvious that the yuan would go up. It might actually go down a little bit. So that's one thing to bear in mind. But the other thing that a lot of American politicians don't get, when we import goods from China, the Chinese value added, that is the portion of the value of the goods that's actually produced in China, can be very small. For example, take an iPhone. You know, everyone loves their iPhones or their iPads. We import those from China. They are made in China. But the Chinese value added is only about 6 or 7% of the price of the goods. Most of the value added comes from Korea. They make the Gorilla Glass that is on the screen. It comes from Germany. It comes from Japan and others who contribute all the parts and technology to make those iPhones. So if you want to change the terms of trade, you're not just cheapening the dollar against the yuan. You have to cheapen the dollar against every major currency in the world, including the Japanese yen, the euro, and the Korean won, and so forth. And that is what the Fed is trying to do. But stop picking on the Chinese. I mean, of course they manipulate their currency, but they're a small part of the problem. You've got to cheapen the dollar against everything. And the point is it doesn't work because we import more than we export. So all you're going to do is raise the price of imported goods, bring inflation into the United States. But that is what the Fed wants. It's the only way out of our debt crisis.
Yep.
You can't pay off the debt in real terms. You have to cheapen the dollar.
You either have to have growth or you have to have inflation in order to deal with the debt. And there's no way with the policies that keep getting implemented that we're going to have growth. So inflation is our best option. Now, here's the thing. I believe wholeheartedly that the world reserve currency of the dollar is going to be a thing of the past sometime in no more than the next decade. Would you agree with that first?
Well, it depends on policy. I don't think it has to be the case. I think it is likely to be the case, but it does depend on policy. I think that President Obama's policies are clearly aimed at cheapening the dollar, and he said so explicitly. But, you know, with a different president after this election or maybe in 2016, you know, you could have a new Ronald Reagan and a new Paul Volcker. Remember, the dollar was actually in worse shape in the late 1970s than it is today. There were people, but there were Americans who went abroad who couldn't even change their dollars. People, in some instances, didn't even want them. And there was a dollar crisis going on in the late 1970s. But that turned around because of Paul Volcker and Ronald Reagan. You know, think about what Volcker and Reagan did. With Volcker and Reagan, we had high interest rates and low taxes. Today, we have low interest rates and high taxes. In other words, we have exactly the opposite of what worked then. But they gave us what's called the King Dollar Policy, and from 1980 to 2010, a period of 30 years, we were on a dollar standard. We were not on a gold standard, but we were on a dollar standard. And a lot of countries anchored their currency to the dollar and kind of relied on us to maintain that value. But beginning in 2010, we tore up that deal and decided to weaken the dollar, and countries have been scrambling ever since. But like I said, what we're going to get is inflation. So, yes, if we keep going with the current policies, I agree that the dollar will not be the world's leading reserve currency for very much longer. But it's not too late to turn it around. It all depends on who's the president and what the policies are.
Okay. Well, Jim, you're going to have to hold on. We've got to take another break. But when we come back, we want to talk about what could be a world reserve currency alternate and what could happen to the United States if something like that happened. But right now, we got to take a break with Terry Troy in traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Rich, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And this is Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Jim Rickards, who wrote the book Currency Wars. If you don't understand how currencies can be used as a military weapon against another nation, you need to be reading this book, because the United States is vulnerable in this area, and you need to understand that. And that's what this book is, a great opportunity to learn a little bit more about it and how vulnerable we are as a country. Jim, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is I saw you do a video recently. It was about a month or so ago, and I don't know if you've changed your opinion, but you were bullish on the euro, and, you know, I would be bullish on the euro except for one thing. There are 17 democratic nations that people can vote in and out of office, politicians that'll do what they want, and they're tired of the pain, they're tired of the austerity, even though that's the best answer, they're tired of it, and, you know, they're going to vote for somebody to come in and tell them, don't worry, you don't have to do this.
Yeah, I really disagree with that, Drew. I've been bullish on the euro for a long time, going back to the summer of 2011. I think Europe's doing everything right. They're moving in the right direction. See, the problem is the entire world, all the major economic sectors, so, you know, the United States, certainly China and East Asia, Japan, Europe, these are, you know, the major drivers of the world economy. They all have to make some structural adjustments. Now, Americans like to call it austerity, as if they are, you know, punishing themselves for no good reason. But what Europe is actually doing, they're going through the necessary structural adjustments so that they can be more productive on a going forward basis. That means, you know, the unit labor costs in Greece and Spain and Italy were too high. There was too much debt. Germany is a much more effective model, much more productive model.
Well, they did that by out of luck, sort of, because they merged with East Germany and they had no choice but to do it, right?
Well, East Germany was actually a large dead weight. Now, they turned it around. By the way, Angela Merkel, you know, the Chancellor of Germany, was an East German. So she grew up and lived in that communist system until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. So initially, there were enormous costs associated with that. But over time, West Germany was able to make East Germany more productive, and now the entire economy is functioning well. So all that's happening is that German model, which was successfully extended from West Germany to East Germany in the 90s, is now being extended to the rest of Europe. This is really the takeover of Europe by Germany, not through military means, but through this economic model. And what they want to do is, by the way, Germany is a really good example of how the right way to compete in the export market. Germany has always had a strong currency, going back at least to the 1960s. They had the Deutschmark at the time. When Nixon went off gold in 1971 to devalue the dollar, he wanted to devalue it against the Deutschmark, and he wanted to make that currency stronger. Well, guess what? He did. The Deutschmark got stronger, the euro got stronger, and Germany is still an export powerhouse. So Germany shows the way. It's education, technology, low taxes, good labor management relations, a good business environment instead of a hostile business environment, which is what we have in the United States. So Germany's done just about everything right. Now they're going to extend that model to the rest of Europe.
Well, wait a minute now. Let me just say that if you had the United States of Europe with Germany as the main thrust of that, then I'd agree with you. You have 17 sovereign nations to get to vote for their own politicians to do whatever they want.
Well, they've been getting the votes. They had a successful referendum. A pro-European party was elected in the Netherlands. Angela Merkel's the most popular politician in Germany since Ludwig Erhard in the 1950s. You've got Mario Monti in Italy, who's a technician, but a democratically elected leader. Rajoy is doing the right thing in Spain. So actually, you're right about the democratic process. But even in Greece, they had an election, and the pro-European parties, the party that wanted to
barely
stay in the euro, barely, but they won. But the point is, you cannot show me an example of where a party won that wanted to leave the euro. No one's going to leave the euro. It's going to stay together. They're going to add members over time, probably Hungary, Estonia, maybe Iceland and some others. Scotland remains to be seen. But that is going to expand. We're getting unified banking regulation, unified deposit insurance. They have been signing up for the fiscal treaty. So what you're saying, Angela Merkel's nickname for this, she just says more Europe, and that's what you're getting. It is being directed by Berlin and Brussels, but it's being directed for very worthy goals in terms of improving the productivity of labor, rationalizing costs. And I expect, the other prop that's going to come in here in a big way is Chinese capital.
I don't disagree with that.
They want to get out of the dollar and into euros. They've been waiting. They didn't want to rush right in because they want to see Europe get their act together. But now that Europe has got its act together, China's ready to come in, not just to buy sovereign bonds, but also to make direct foreign investment, infrastructure. They want to buy sensitive technology that's been denied to them, defense contractors, highway systems, ports, et cetera. So there's a combination of youth labor, Chinese capital, German technology, and German leadership. It's going to turn Spain, Italy, and Greece into what I call Singapore and the Mediterranean. It's a very bullish case.
That would be fantastic. I would absolutely agree with that. We don't have much time left, so let's go back to the currency wars. China and Russia have both been saying, hey, enough is enough. Time for the U.S. dollar no longer be the world currency reserve. We need an alternate. And many times they talk about using these, what are they called, special drawing rights?
Yeah, the SDR, special drawing rights, that's correct.
Something like that. I mean, do you think that's even possible?
Well, it is possible over not very long period of time. So here's the thing. You can use whatever you want for a trade currency. A trade currency just means, you and I trade with each other, and we keep score, and every now and then we settle up the difference. And you can use the Chinese yuan and the Brazilian real and other currencies to do that. But for that matter, you could use baseball cards or bottle caps. But to be a reserve currency, you need investable assets. If I have reserves, I want to invest them in something. And that's been the strength of the United States. We have the largest bond market. We have stuff you can invest in. There is no Chinese bond market to speak of. So China will never have a reserve currency until they have a bond market. Well, the same thing applies to the SDR. But a year and a half ago, the IMF came out with a multi-year plan to do exactly that, to create a bond market. They listed issuers. They listed investors, a set of dealers, an issuance calendar, financing facilities, derivative products, et cetera, to turn the SDR into a global reserve currency. So the international monetary system has collapsed three times in the past 100 years. It collapsed in 1914 when countries went off gold to fight World War I. It collapsed in 1939 at the beginning of World War II. And it collapsed again in 1971 when Nixon went off the gold standard. Each time it was reformed under some new standards. So I do expect another collapse sooner than later. When you say who are the candidates to be the new global reserve currencies, SDRs are one of them. That's certainly right. That's what the elites want. But the other one, don't forget, is gold. We could be back on some kind of gold standard. I don't think central bankers want gold, but if you have a chaotic collapse, they may have no choice.
So if my listeners, because you have to leave real soon, so let's just end with this. If my listeners wanted to watch one or two things that would give them a warning that something bad is happening, what would you say that they should be watching?
The number one thing is the price of gold. If you, the thing is, looking at the dollar-euro cross rate doesn't tell you very much because they could both be going down against gold. So I would just watch the price of gold. Gold is inverse to the dollar. When people say gold is going up, it's going up, up, up. But what's really happening is your dollar is going down, down, down. Gold is the constant store of value. When gold supposedly goes up in dollars, what it means is the dollar is collapsing. So I'd watch the price of gold. In fact, I would own some gold. Not all in, but I think people should have between 10 and 20% of their investable assets in gold.
You mean gold bullion or gold electronic ETFs or something like that?
Yeah, I like physical coins. The American Gold Eagle is a reliable coin, and they're about, with commission, they rebate $1,700, $1,800 for a 1 ounce coin. So, if you had $100,000, that would be, however many coins, that would be about 14 coins or so.
What's the other thing that they should be watching?
Well, obviously watch inflation, the thing with inflation is it starts out slowly and then it jumps. So the Fed is talking 2%, but they really wanted to get it to 4%. But the problem is when it goes to 4, it won't stop there. It could shoot right up to 7. So if you see inflation getting up beyond 3% and gold getting up over $2,000, I mean, I would prepare now. I would have some gold now, but those are definite warning signs that things are not getting better.
Jim, you're going on television soon. Best to you on that, and we really appreciate your time, sir.
Glad to do it. Glad to be part of the show.
Thank you. And that was Jim Rickards, author of Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. And we suggest that you get that book on Amazon.com or something of that sort. But right now, we've got to take a break. 6:45. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
So, I'm on an open show for the last 10 minutes of this show. If anybody wants to call and ask a question real quick, 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. If not, I'm just going to talk for about 10 minutes. So if you didn't find that interesting, I don't know what would be of interest to you, because what he just said to you at the very beginning of this show is that the United States military, the National Security Defense people, the National Security Administration, and the Department of Treasury were all so concerned about the financial system of our country and the currency of our country that they literally played a war game in a war room to see how they would defend our country and our currency and our bond market and our stock market if it was attacked. And, you just have to understand how important this really is. You need to read this book and understand that this is not something that you can just, fluff off, I'm trying to say something there, and I can't get it out. You can't just ignore it. There you go. That's a good way of saying it. You just can't ignore it. It's an important issue. And I'm not with him. I don't think you should have 10 to 20% of your money in gold coins. I don't necessarily know that that's appropriate. But, I definitely think that having some kind of precious metal is not a bad thing. But I think it can also be electronic. You know, if you look at all these situations that he went through, there was only one period of time when a gold electronic investment would not have been valuable, and that was 1930 when Roosevelt made it illegal to own gold. And so if there was an electronic, they would have had to give you your money back and you would not have had any gold. But otherwise, every other time, it worked, and it worked well. So because, holding gold is a very difficult thing. So anyway, I'm not as optimistic as he is also about Europe. And I agree with him wholeheartedly that if they're successful, if these people are willing to change their ways, allow their unions to be modified, allow their legislation to be modified, continue with the austerity, get rid of their the wrong things that they've done, they could be incredibly successful, and the euro will be a raving success. I'm just not convinced that in a democratic nation people are going to accept the pain that's necessary to get there. And somebody's going to come along and say, you don't have to do that. And they're going to agree with them. I mean, look what we did. Anyway, that's another story. Tom in Lutherville, how can we help you?
Hi, Drew. How you doing?
Good. And you?
Good, good. Hey, I've been hearing on other radio stations about these guys that are touting these
annuities.
Is that what it is, where you get
their annuities?
You can't lose any money?
Absolutely. And it's all smoke and mirrors. It's a bunch of BS. And if you really sat down with their marketing material and somebody who really knew what they were doing, they could show you that everything they're talking about is smoke and mirrors, BS. It makes a lot of money for them. Here's a simple way of looking at it, Tom. You ready? Most of these products that they're selling, The companies that are selling the product are paying a minimum of 6% to 10% to these salespeople to sell it. Now, let me tell you something. If it was a great investment, you would think that all you have to do is put it on the internet today and people will flock to it and buy it without paying 6 to 10% commissions. The reason they pay those commissions is you need somebody to BS their way through it and convince you that you need to give them your money. All right?
Yep.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Will in Baltimore, how can I help you?
Well, hello this evening. I was going to talk about politics, but I said, you know what? I'll talk about politics from a different angle. Question 7. I'll tell you what. I'm tired of going to Delaware, to New Jersey, all these.
What is question 7?
Oh. Let me see. Question 7. Oh, well, in my state, we have a question to get table games.
Oh, okay, right.
Right.
You're talking casinos.
Right. Is this show is based in Maryland, right?
Yeah, we're okay. personal finance. So you got to make it quick because I'm not here to talk about casinos.
That's the whole point. It will bring a ton of jobs. It will generate a lot of taxes. But that's the main thing. I'm going out there to get a job when they bring those table games in there. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. And so,
all right, I got to go.
How do you think that can affect our economy, you know, having all that additional income?
I have no problem. If you let it go in a free market way and you let them bring casinos, people want to spend their money gambling, they can feel free to do that. Fred and Perry Hall.
Oh, hey, Drew. Hey, listen, great interview. Thank you very much. Mr. Rickards is somebody that I've followed for a few years now. And I think the point that he's trying to make on gold by holding gold coins instead of some paper vehicle like the folks at MF Global that lost their...
Yeah, I hear you.
Is that there's no counterparty risk.
That's true, but you do...
Trying to get at.
You do have storage risk. You do have to make sure that you have it somewhere. You got to either get a safe deposit box or you got to keep it somewhere completely safe in your house, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and it does cost money to buy physical gold and it costs money to sell physical gold more than most people would realize.
It does, but let's take a look at the 10-year return on gold. On a gold eagle, it's pretty amazing.
Yes, but a 10-year return on the gold eagle between 1980 and 2000 was pretty awful.
But quite honestly, you don't see the political system changing, do you? I mean, money is going to be printed.
Fred, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that, you know, between 1980 and 2000, we ran an average inflation rate of about 3%, but the average person investing in gold during that 20-year period of time lost 70% of their money. Okay? So just because you have inflation doesn't mean that gold's going to be a winner, but I wouldn't disagree with you. Right now, because of the supply and demand issues of gold, gold is a reasonably good investment to still consider, even at $1,600, $1,700 an ounce.
Well, the forecast that I mean, if you look at Mr. Rickards, I bet you he's calling for some pretty astounding...
If you went back to a gold standard, Fred, you could literally get a gold price of $10,000 to $20,000 an ounce, because that's what it would take to bring the gold standard back to the world.
That's exactly right.
And he said in his book, he specifically said that if you went back to a gold standard and they raised the price to something like $10,000, $20,000, they'd probably have some kind of windfall tax or whatever that they would take from people who have any kind of gold investments. Okay, but, you know, that'd be hard if you have it physically. So there's a good argument for you to own it physically, as opposed to... But then again, if you bring it out physically to try to turn it into dollars, they'd be able to take their windfall tax from you, though, wouldn't they?
Time will tell the story.
Yeah, time will tell the story. You know, here's my point, Fred. Don't get enamored that you have the clue or you have the golden goose with any investment. There's no such thing. Apple's not the perfect investment. Gold's not the perfect investment. There's no such thing as a perfect investment. All right? That's my only point, you know? I think it's a great point that Fred's made, and we really appreciate it. Next week, we will be back. Money, riches, and wealth. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.